Young Muslims at 80 beats per minute. Today, Wednesday, March 5th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A scholar notices kids from all over the world flocking to the Bronx.
One of them told me, you know, we're making our pilgrimage to the Mecca of hip-hop. So I became interested in the role that the Bronx and hip-hop and African-American Islam and Black American culture plays in youth culture around the world.
Also today, what we can learn from epic failures, like the one that destroyed a $125 million Mars climate orbiter.
Some people were using the metric system and some were using the imperial measurement system. So the whole thing just blew up.
Plus, a daughter who bonded with her Polish mother over her potato and cheese pierogies.
She never had a recipe, you know, because she said, if it's too wet, you just add a little more flour. If it's too dry, you add a little more water.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Crimea today, pretty much the same as yesterday. In a word, unsettled. Russian troops are still in control of the Crimean Peninsula, and Russian President Vladimir Putin isn't backing off from his position that Moscow reserves the right to use force to protect ethnic Russians in Ukraine. In Paris today, U.S. and European diplomats tried to pressure the Russians to negotiate directly with the new Ukrainian authorities, but so far, no breakthrough. So that's keeping people in Crimea on edge. One group that's especially worried is the Crimean Tatars. They have a history with Russia. Natalia Antalava has a story.
Like many 15-year-olds around the world, Medina spends a lot of time on Facebook. But unlike most teenagers, she logs in to discuss politics.
Конечно, это сейчас это на данный момент это самый популярный вопрос.
The most popular subject for me and my friends is definitely the current situation here in Crimea. So we are always exchanging messages, updating each other on the situation. We are so worried.
As the crisis over Crimea continues, everyone here is anxious, but especially families like Medina's. They're Crimean Tatars, Muslims who are the indigenous people of the peninsula. In 1944, Stalin deported the entire Tatar population of Crimea to Central Asia. In the living room, Medina's grandparents, Zenife and Zavre, are watching the news. That's all we do, they tell me. The couple were among the very first Crimean Tatars to return here in 1969. Thousands followed in the 1980s, even though discrimination against them continued until the Soviet Union collapsed. And now, once again, the fear has returned. In the past few days, Zenife tells me, a few of her neighbors had their houses marked with crosses. She says Crimean Tatars are scared of the dormant ethnic tensions that the Russian troop presence has unleashed. We have nowhere to go, Zenife says. Russians have Russia, Ukrainians can go to Ukraine. But Crimea is their only home. Every day, Zenife goes to peaceful protests against the Russian troops. I join her. The demonstrators are all women and children. They wave blue and yellow balloons, the color of the Ukrainian flag. Once upon a time, Crimean Tatars had their own state, but now they believe their best chance of survival is with Ukraine.
Мы за мир! Крым, Украина! Крым, Украина!
We want peace. Crimea is Ukraine, the women shout. Across the road from them, armed Russian troops in balaclavas are blocking a Ukrainian military base. 2 hours later, a TV report about this demonstration is ready to go on air. This is a Crimean Tatar television station called ATR. Also in the news today is the visit of an official delegation of Muslims from Russia. They've come to meet with Crimean Tatars. Linur Yunusov, a journalist at ATR, explains why.
We can see how actively the new government in Crimea, which is backed by Russia, is trying to get Crimean Tatars on their side. They're promising financial packages, government posts. There's been a whole string of delegations from Russia's Muslim regions trying to negotiate with us. And this is because today, the future of this pro-Moscow government depends on whether Crimean Tatars support it or not.
Crimean Tatars represent only 15% of the population, but politically they matter. Crimea's new pro-Moscow government plans to hold a referendum in May on the peninsula's greater autonomy from Kiev. They need Tatar votes. Driving through Simferopol, Eskandar Bariyev is on his cell phone, talking politics. He's a deputy in the Mejlis, the representative body for the Crimean Tatars. Iskandar fears that the Russians will make an offer that Crimean Tatars will struggle to refuse, a sort of autonomy that they have always dreamt of. It will put them into an incredibly difficult position. But he says with memories of deportation still alive, he can't imagine Crimean Tatars aligning themselves with Russia. Back in Bakhchisarai, Medina is playing with her baby brother. Their future feels uncertain. Crimean Tatars may be firmly behind the pro-Western government in Kiev. But pro-Moscow forces are already in charge here, and pressure on the Crimean Tatars is increasing. They worry what will happen if they continue to refuse to back the new regime. For The World, I'm Natalia Antalava in Bakhchisarai in Crimea.
My grandfather came to the U.S. from what is now Ukraine, from just outside the western Ukrainian city of Lvov in a small town called Rozdol. He left as a teenager, and before he took the ship to America in the late 1800s, he crossed the Carpathian Mountains and went next door to live in Krakow in Poland. That gives you a sense of the proximity of Ukraine and Poland, but it's more than just geography. They're tied up in other ways, too. So how is Poland seeing what's going on in Ukraine right now? Dr. Andrew Mikta is a professor of international studies at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, and a senior fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis in Washington. Dr. Mikta, please explain, what's on the mind of the officials there in Poland right now?
This is a seminal event for Poland, actually for the entire Central European or Nordic Baltic Central European region. For the Poles, this is something that is redefining the security of their country and is becoming a test for NATO. For Poland, it also invokes a lot of the past, as you've indicated. Poland and Ukraine have had a very complex, very interconnected relationship. If you go back several centuries, they're actually part of the same state, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. But most of all, it looks at Ukraine as essential to the security not just of Poland, but also of the whole region. And conversely, it looks at what Russia is doing as a resurgence of a near-imperial position that the Putin presidency has been pursuing.
I mean, I can see how Russia is influential on the whole region, but Ukraine, I mean, the troubles are in Ukraine, not in Poland. How does what's happening in Ukraine affect the security of Poland?
The Poles see this as a longer-term trend of essentially Russia shifting the momentum and now putting counter pressure. And they see the events in Ukraine largely as only the first step. Subsequent events likely, from their perspective, impacting Moldova, impacting Georgia, and even if you look at the NATO alliance itself, putting pressure on the Baltic states and Poland itself.
Generally, though, would you say Poland and Ukraine are friendly today?
Very much so. And actually, if you look at the whole idea of the European Union Eastern Partnership was largely driven by Poland and Sweden here, but Polish Foreign Minister Sikorski was the forefather, so to speak, of the whole idea of greater engagement to the East. Poland has, since the collapse of communism, has seen good relations with Ukraine as an essential element of its national security policy. Let me underline one very important element here. Mm. Poland is extremely concerned about the breakup of Ukraine. Any sort of outcome, and unfortunately with the Russian military move into Crimea, that is already happening to some extent.
What's their big fear if that happens?
Well, the fear is then that what you're going to have is essentially, A, you'll have a militarization of the conflict. You don't really know in what fashion the Ukrainian people would respond to any direct military confrontation. From the Polish perspective, preserving the integrity of Ukraine has been a number one priority, and then preventing Russia from using military power in Ukraine. It's a geopolitical game that's unfolding before our eyes, and it's going to redefine how Europe and Russia relate to each other.
Dr. Andrew Mikta, thanks very much for your thoughts on this.
My pleasure.
The tensions in Ukraine are affecting travel to and from the region. That includes student groups that just happen to be planning to visit the country. So let me take you to Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, up in Canada, where some high schoolers will not be going on a scheduled trip to Ukraine over their upcoming break. Their exchange has been called off because of the crisis. Lorian Gabruk is a teacher at Bethlehem High School. Now, you've been organizing these trips to Ukraine since 1996, so this has got to be a big disappointment, not just for the kids, but for you too.
Oh, it's definitely a big disappointment. You know, relations that have been fostered over the years and me not being able to see my friends and even collaborate with my colleagues there. Not just that, but this trip was going to have some differences in it from previous trips, and we were quite looking forward to that.
So what was going to be different about this trip?
We were going to be centered closer to Lviv as opposed to Chernivtsi, which is the city that we have exchanged with in the past, and Lviv is a more Ukrainian-speaking area, and as well spending some time in the Carpathian Mountains to a greater extent than we have in the past, giving the kids some other cultural and linguistic opportunities to use their language to hear some of the other Ukrainian dialects that do exist as well.
Well, it sounds like fun. Why was the trip canceled?
The trip was canceled because of the volatility and situation in Ukraine, the school board taking into consideration our safety of the students and of myself.
Fear of getting caught up in a revolution. Were you already sort of thinking about canceling the trip before Russian troops went into Crimea?
We were just kind of waiting it out and trying to see what was going to be happening.
So for you, what's the highlight of these trips? I mean, why do you keep going back?
Oh, for me, the highlight has to be I do teach Ukrainian at Bethlehem High School. Our students have an opportunity to study Ukrainian as an additional language. Along with the language, we, of course, cover some of the history, some of the cultural components of Ukraine and of being Ukrainian. So many times it's the aha moments that the students have when they walk into one of the historic church buildings, which we would have talked about, and the history goes back 1,000 years, I guess, and they realize that this is where it happened. Or the moments when the students get to a village from where their ancestors come, and realize that that's really where their roots are. And it is really touching, and it can be, it is very emotional sometimes how it does touch the students, even though the students who do go are very Canadian, very North American, but realizing their Ukrainian roots.
And even though the exchange is not happening now, I assume Ukrainian students are not coming to Saskatoon either.
It's still in negotiation,
oh.
And we're still going to invite and try and have the Ukrainian students come to Saskatoon in probably late August. Hopefully, if things settle down in Ukraine a little bit, then our group may be able to travel, say, next Easter.
Are you encouraging your students anyway to just reach out, you know, through social media to those Ukrainian students and just to kind of find out what is going on?
Oh, they're definitely encouraged. What my students do is they do write up a biography and we send it to their partners in Ukraine. And some of them have started to Skype. And so I do encourage them to keep up with what is going on as well, and sharing it with their classmates, because it is a world issue. I think it's bigger than just our exchange. They need to spread the word too.
Yeah, definitely. And what about you, Lorian? I mean, what are some of the things you've heard from Ukraine, from your friends there?
My friends that are living in Western Ukraine, life is, for the most part for them, it's going on. They're going to work. The kids are going to school. Of course, it's tense, and there's a lot of heartache for the losses that were suffered in Kyiv in February.
But as you say, these are people in Western Ukraine, far from what's happening in Crimea.
That's right.
Yeah.
But life does go on for them.
Well, Lorian Gabruk, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Still to come on The World, a sculpture park or a soundscape? You'll decide on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There's a great scene in Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator where his Hitler-inspired character, Hinkle, is being shown the regime's latest military invention.
Hail, Hinkle, Your Excellency. Actions speak louder than words. A bulletproof uniform.
And 100% perfect.
Shoot.
Far from perfect.
Yeah, far from perfect. But as inventors have long known, you make a mistake and you retool, you tweak. Failure is good, and that's the basic idea behind an exhibit at Dublin's Trinity College. The show is called Fail Better, and Michael John Gorman is a curator. So it's basically the idea behind, if at first you don't succeed, then try again. Was that the starting point?
Yes, very much so, Marco. So Fail Better was inspired by the importance of failure in creativity and invention. You know, from Thomas Edison's light bulbs to Facebook's Fail Hard.
So two inventions that stand out for me in this show, one about the Mars Climate Orbiter and another one about a device to help mother elephants give birth. Let's start with the Mars Climate Orbiter story. What happened there?
So the Mars Climate Orbiter was a major $125 million project, and it unfortunately never made it to where it was meant to make it in Mars because the different teams involved, there was European teams and the US teams, they confused the measurement system. Some people were using the metric system and some were using the imperial measurement system. So the whole thing just blew up 170 kilometers from the surface of Mars.
Wow. Now, you actually have an example of what you claim is the world's worst invention. This doesn't really sound like human error. This is that elephant birthing contraption I was talking about. Tell us about it and who came up with that.
It's called the Blonsky device. It was invented by an American couple called the Blonskys. And they went to the zoo and they saw a female elephant that was about to give birth. And the female elephant was rotating slowly. And the zookeeper told them that this was something that all elephants do, not correct, in fact, and that it facilitated the birthing process. So then they had the wonderful idea that if elephants can do this, why not humans? So they come up with this invention in 1965, and the invention whirls the expectant mother around extremely quickly with the idea that the centrifugal force will assist in the delivery of the baby. Fortunately, this was never actually built and used, and we've rebuilt it for the first time from the patent drawings, so it's actually on display at the Science Gallery in Trinity College Dublin now.
You know, there's the mantra, if you forget the past, you're bound to repeat it. I mean, we see examples all the time where that is ignored in terms of history, and yet the idea of failing in areas like innovation and what you've seen in your exhibit is catching on, and people see value in failure. How do you get policymakers to pick up the baton of learning from past mistakes?
One of the messages of this exhibition is that failure is not always good. It can come at great economic cost, great social cost. And one of the problems with policy level failures is that they haven't been informed by a process of prototyping so that, you know, when they fail, the consequences can be really significant. But I suppose the question we want to ask is how can we introduce a process which is innately familiar to designers and inventors, to policymaking, where things can be really properly prototyped before they become national level policy.
Michael John Gorman, he's the curator of Fail Better. The show is at the Science Gallery at Trinity College in Dublin. Michael, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
You know, chefs do a lot of prototyping, too. They're constantly testing out new recipes. Today in our series on the global tastemakers of New York City, we want you to meet Katajana Poshai. She's a chef and co-owner of Petit Oven, a restaurant in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. The restaurant serves French-American food, although Poshai was born and raised in Poland, and Polish food is still close to her heart. She grew up on her mother's pierogies, little stuffed dumplings filled with all kind of goodness. When Poshai was 5 years old, her mother, Ella, left Poland for the United States. This was in 1982. Poland was still a communist state, closely allied with the Soviet Union. Ella arrived here on a visitor's visa and was allowed to stay, but Katajana and her sister couldn't go with their mother.
we couldn't get a visa for whatever reason it was. I was too young to know at that time. We ended up moving with her parents, my grandparents, on a small farm in Poland, which was in Wagenka, which I would say the population was 14 households or so. So it was small.
And sets the stage for World War II. Poland's 34 million inhabitants, crushed, scattered, and enslaved.
My grandmother, Babcia, she never threw a piece of food out because she remembered days during the war where there was nothing to eat. She engraved in us the importance of food. It was still very hard in Poland to get food, even in stores. This was the mid-80s. Communism was breaking up at that moment. Things were starting to change, but I still remember my grandparents, my uncle, getting stamps for, let's say, a kilo of kielbasa or things like that. So if you lived on a farm, you could grow your own vegetables, you could grow your own produce, fruits, and animals, and really survive it in that way, because it was really impossible to any other way. Usually around the holidays, my grandfather, my uncle, all the men would get together and they would slaughter the pig, make blood sausage, kielbasa. We did a recipe called świeżonka, which is fresh meat, which still has to be warm within 2 or 3 hours of slaughtering the animal. And you take the meat, it usually comes from around the pork butt, the ham. It's a little bit of a fatty, kind of chunky meat, and you just sauté it with a lot of onion, and you braise it for about 45 minutes, an hour. And it's just so unique. In 1987, my sister and I, we moved to the U.S. We reconnected with my mother, Elżbieta Ploje, but everybody called her Ella. And she started cooking, and we started enjoying her food again, her fabulous food, her amazing pierogies, which became to be known as Ella's pierogies. I've tried to get the recipe so many times. She never had a recipe, you know, because she said, if it's too wet, you just add a little more flour. If it's too dry, you add a little more water. But what she was really famous for was her potato and cheese pierogies. We sold them at the restaurant at some point. She would do like 50 dozen in a couple hours, like a machine, like a robot, just boom, 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 you know. And unfortunately, my mother is not here anymore. She passed last week, but I still have a couple bags in the freezer. I think the role that food played in my mother's heart is just being a mother and just providing really, really great food for her children and for her whole family. And we celebrated and celebrated life.
Food as love, food as life. That was Polish-born chef Katarzyna Porszaj in Brooklyn, New York. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, we hear about a Chilean writer who grew up during the Pinochet years and about his strange hometown.
It's kind of one of those places that's in the middle of nowhere, and it was kind of a bedroom community, and people would take the train in, and the kids were left on their own. There were no adults around during the day. Everyone went to either the city, the Santiago, or the coast to work, and the kids created their own culture.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. American troops are preparing to leave Afghanistan by the end of this year. Some could stay if an agreement is reached between the U.S. and Afghanistan before that. But that may not happen, and many Afghans are very worried. They fear that the American withdrawal could be followed by a spike in violence and maybe even a return to the way things were under the Taliban. One group of Afghans who are especially concerned are photographers. They're the subject of a new documentary called Frame by Frame. It's by American filmmakers Mo Scarpelli and Alexandria Bomback.
Photography specifically, along with a lot of other things, were banned during the Taliban regime starting in 1996. And so when that ended in 2001 with 9/11 and that regime was gone and the ban was lifted, it just has been a revolution of photography in the last 12 years of people taking it on and also, you know, really building careers with it and economy around it. So it's gone from a complete blackout to a total resurgence.
This is Mo. I guess I just want to reiterate how devastating this media blackout was for the Taliban to actually have a policy in place that said it is illegal to take a photograph. And so each of our photographers, the four characters in our film, have their own personal history of no photography or secret photography or whatever they did. One of the photographers shot in secret, and we have access to this really incredible footage that and photography that nobody else got because people just weren't willing to risk their lives to go out and take photos.
Mo Scarpelli, there's a photographer you follow named Farzana Wahidi. She's the first female photojournalist in Afghanistan. What is her story?
She's amazing. Farzana has a really unique history. Of the four characters, she's the only one who stayed in Afghanistan for her entire life. So she was there during the Civil War. She was there during the Taliban regime. She went to school in secret, hiding her books as she walked through the streets to get to a secret school at someone's apartment. She helped raise her family. She was looking for a way to be a powerful person in her life, to have her own power as a woman. And her family was supportive, which is pretty unique at that time. And also, I think even now, unique to have a father who said, yes, go get an education, work. I support you as a person, as a professional. And so she did. And she's built her own career, basically, from scratch.
And this is all post 9/11?
Post 9/11, she in 2001, she heard about this group called INA, which is a photojournalism training. She was 17 years old, and she was like, I have to do this. And so she actually lied about her age because you had to be 18 to apply. And she got in, and she's now always, for the rest of her life, going to say she's like a year older. But as a woman, it's hard to work in Afghanistan. It really is. But the other side of that coin is that she has a super unique access with women in Afghanistan.
One of the photographers you follow is a man named Masoud Hosseini. He's won a Pulitzer, the only Afghan to have ever done so. I was surprised to hear him express how certain he was that once U.S. troops leave, the Taliban will come back. Did the other three share that same concern? And do these photographers just worry that their professions and the whole ability to, you know, document stuff might suddenly evaporate again if a similar Taliban orthodoxy were to come back?
This is Alexandria. I think with Masoud, you know, there's so many passionate emotions going on with what people feel the future will be. It really is a time where people don't know what's going to happen. Everyone thought that Karzai was going to sign the agreement with the U.S. right away. We thought the Lori Jirga was going to go through, all these different things, you know. So, and our other characters, as far as like how they felt, Najibullah Musafir, he, you know, is very confident in Afghanistan, that Afghanistan is going to go into a bright future. Masoud is a little less optimistic, and Farzana is optimistic, but also has seen what can happen. So it's very fascinating to go through the experience with each one of these characters, because they all have such different opinions of what they see happening in the future.
Well, Alexandria Bombach, Mo Scarpelli, filmmakers behind the documentary Frame by Frame, thanks for speaking with us and for telling these photographers' stories. Greatly appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Thank you.
And you can see a trailer for their film at PRI.org. The dreaded return to the old days of the Taliban isn't a hypothetical threat. The Taliban routinely stage attacks all over Afghanistan, killing scores of people. The world's Nina Porizuki remembers now one businessman in the capital, Kabul, who went to great lengths to protect his customers from all the violence.
It takes a lot to shake up those living and working in Kabul, Afghanistan. But at the beginning of the year, an attack on a popular expat restaurant in town did just that.
A Taliban suicide squad has killed 21 people at a restaurant in Kabul in the deadliest attack on foreign civilians.
One of those 21 people killed inside that restaurant was the owner of the restaurant, Kamal Hamade.
What I remember of my brother Kamal is that he had a strong personality, and to this day I have not been able to beat him in backgammon.
Zuhair Hamade is a physician who's practiced in Massachusetts for more than 30 years. He and his five other brothers, there are seven Hamade brothers total, learned of their brother Kamal's death from news reports.
I heard about it from my brother, who's in Florida, who had seen it online. It was very distressing the first several hours because we all knew that the restaurant was attacked, but we had no idea whether he had survived or not.
A suicide bomber and two gunmen attacked the restaurant. Hamade was there, as he always was.
People also expressing grief for the owner of the restaurant, who was a well-known Lebanese businessman in town. He was very much so a loved figure because his restaurant was...
And one thing he was known for is his chocolate cake. He would bake it himself.
And he often sent complimentary slices of cake to customers at the end of their meals. That was a small part of what made his restaurant, the Taverna du Liban, an oasis in Kabul. That and the bodyguards out front and inside.
The moment you step in, it's like immediately Kabul has just been shut out and you've entered into a place where you feel like you can relax. We would always go and celebrate there because he just was able to create such an oasis. It was pretty amazing.
Erin Jensen has lived in Kabul for 7 years with her children and her husband, who works for the international school there. They were regulars at the Taverna and they knew Hamade well.
As soon as we would walk in the door, he'd ask us about our children. He'd ask us about the school. He knew personal things about us, which, to be honest, for a while I thought was maybe just something specific to us. But it didn't take long, you know, maybe a year or two into being here, I realized that's how he interacted with all of his clients. He knew everyone.
And he especially loved children. He had two daughters of his own, and Jensen remembers how Hamade held her infant daughter one evening at the restaurant.
And he said to me when I went to get her back, he said, you know, holding this baby reminds me of my family. It makes me miss my family. A lot of times I can just kind of forget. That's kind of how you survive in Kabul, is you kind of have to shut the outside world out a little bit.
When the outside world did abruptly burst in and the restaurant was attacked this past January, Hamade led his staff out a back door to safety. He then reportedly went back inside to try and help his patrons.
We feel as if his death brought home to us all the dangers and the suffering that Afghanis and expatriates in Kabul are going through. Before that, it was a distant event, a distant news, but now it brought it home to our house and to my family and our family.
This violence is a daily reality for many families in Afghanistan. Elections are a month out, but it remains to be seen if a change in leadership really changed this daily reality all that much. Taverna du Liban owner Kamal Hamade was 60 years old. For The World, I'm Nina Porizuki.
Everyone snaps pictures while on vacation, but only a few record the sounds they encounter on their travels. Today's GeoQuiz comes to us from one of those few.
Hi, my name is Jorge Ayala. I'm an artist based in Toronto, Canada. One of the things that I like to do is capturing the sounds of the places I visit. It helps me remember the place in a different way than a photograph would ever do. Okay, this sound that I want to share with you today, I recorded at Figeland Park. It's one of Norway's biggest sculpture parks. These sculptures were made by Gustav Figeland, one of Norway's most outstanding sculptors. He also designed the park.
So, which Norwegian city is the park in? And what's up with all that scraping and crashing? You've got just a few minutes to come up with the answer. So one of the great things about hosting The World is that I get to learn about things I probably wouldn't even know about otherwise. Here's a great example.
Crecimos con el sonido de la voz de nuestros padres viniendo de lejos, convertido en un murmullo sin sentido que nos quemaba los oídos.
That's the voice of Chilean writer Álvaro Bisama. He's reading an excerpt from his novel Noise. What you're not seeing is the beautiful animated film that goes with his reading. It's eerie, but full of magical realism and trippy colors, and it's up now at our website, PRI.org. The short film was produced by our partners at Radio Ambulante, working with Colombian artist and illustrator Nelly Ragua. Radio Ambulante's Daniel Alacon says Bisama's novel tells a powerful story set during a traumatic period in Chile's recent history.
It's about being a child during the dictatorship, during the kind of the dark Pinochet years. And he himself was raised in a town called Villa Alemana, which is sort of like the comparable to Seattle in some ways, like the grunge capital of Chilean rock, and a place with a lot of mysticism and a lot of history, and a lot of great bands have come out of there. And he grew up during this time, and we selected an excerpt that sort of captures some of the most powerful images from that text, which is basically what it means.
Tell us what we're seeing.
We're seeing, you know, the train that takes people to the coast. We're seeing the long-distance phone calls with exiled relatives, you know, living in Europe, in Mexico. We're seeing skulls, you know, representing the dead and the unidentified grave sites. You know, we're seeing all of that. And that those are the stark memories from his own childhood.
Right. So tell us more about Álvaro Bisama. This is the writer whose work was brought to life in this animation. You actually got to know him, right?
Yeah, Álvaro's a friend of mine. We've known each other since 2007. He's you know, written three or four novels now that I think are just really, really great. They're very musical, very rhythmic, and you can hear that in this excerpt that we have.
Did you get a sense of what motivates him as a writer, and kind of like why did he end up in the camp of the punk rockers and not some other group?
I think it was just the culture of Villa Alemana, you know. It was kind of a bedroom community, and people would take the train in, and the kids were left on their own, basically, is what he tells me.
Wow.
There were no adults around during the day. Everyone went to either the city, the Santiago, or the coast to work, and the kids created their own culture. It sounds to me just like an absolutely bizarre place to grow up, and God bless writers who have the talent to encapsulate that.
With the subtitles in this animation, Daniel, I found myself getting kind of happily schooled in Spanish. Was part of this idea to bring another dimension to radio, to make Spanish literature more accessible to a non-Spanish audience?
Well, you know, I kind of have a foot in both worlds, you know, in American letters and Latin American letters, and I feel really happy to be able to connect those two worlds. So to bring Alvaro's piece into English with these images, with those subtitles. Yeah, it's part of our mission as Radio Ambulante. It's part of a kind of a personal mission of mine to get them an audience that they deserve.
Daniel, thanks for speaking with us. Great to talk to you.
As always, Marco. Take care.
Daniel Alarcón of Radio Ambulante, which is supported by the New Visions, New Voices project. You'll definitely want to check out the animation created by Nelly Ragua and Álvaro Bisama. That's at PRI.org. Okay, so a few minutes ago, we heard from sound artist Jorge Ayala in our GeoQuiz. He shared a recording he made while visiting a sculpture park in Norway. Jorge is back now to tell us what that sound was and what city he was in.
The sound that we're listening now, I captured it in a very special place called the Vigeland Park in the city of Oslo. And as I started walking, I started hearing all these sounds. It sounded like skateboarders. It was a contest. There was some sort of competition. So they were all pretty good. Probably 30 or 40 of them doing flips and jumps and all kind of stuff. All these tricks were really on point. And I sat down to watch it, and I pulled out my recorder. It was pretty close to where they were, so I closed my eyes and I heard that, and I realized at that moment that was something that I needed to capture. That's a very specific sound that triggers memories of my youth and my friends. I used to skateboard, but I was pretty bad at it. I totally sucked. So I would do it because I wanted to learn, but then at a point when I realized, like, this is not for me, so I just hang out with my friends. It was kind of like they will be doing most of the cool stuff, and I'll just be kind of like, you know, cheering them up and trying my thing, but never really going anywhere, to be honest. Just having a good time with my friends. And I don't remember seeing anybody falling or having a, you know, doing anything ugly, but it was a very lovely experience, and I would like to encourage you to do something similar. Just grab your phone, pick up a soundscape that interests you, and record it. And it will give you different ways to remember a place. Those sounds really were one of the prettiest ones I heard in a long time. My name is Jorge Ayala, and I live in Toronto, Canada.
Thank you, Jorge. So the answer to our GeoQuiz today is Oslo, Norway, home to the Vigeland Sculpture Park and the skateboarders who do their thing there. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Islam and music sometimes have an uneasy relationship. Some Muslims believe that playing musical instruments and singing should be forbidden, but others, including Muslim youth in many parts of the world, happily embrace all sorts of music, and that includes hip-hop, jazz, and reggae. Hisham Aidi is the author of Rebel Music, Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture. He says he started his research more than a decade ago, exploring the music scene in the Bronx and Harlem.
Kids were coming in from France and Brazil and Argentina and various parts of the world, some Muslim, some not Muslim. And they'd come up to the Bronx, to Crotona Park, to meet with some of the hip-hop pioneers, to take the Mambo to Hip-Hop tour, to visit Malcolm X's grave. And many of them were making, one of them told me, you know, we're making our pilgrimage to the Mecca of hip-hop. So I became interested in the role that the Bronx and hip-hop and African-American Islam and Black American culture plays in youth culture around the world, and also and particularly among Muslim youth.
One trend you've been spotting in this music is a kind of almost nostalgia for the radical chic of the 60s and 70s, you know, Black Power, the Nation of Islam, the fight against colonialism. I'd like our listeners to hear a French rapper that you discuss, a guy named Medine, so we can see just what you mean.
J'en ai passé des soirées comme celle-ci à regarder le ciel illuminé par les tirs de mortier. 48 ans de ma vie sur cette planète et je revois mon pays en fouillant bien dans ma tête.
Wow, Medine sounds like he's about to explode, Hisham. I mean, this song of his, Du Panchir à Harlem, or From Panchir to Harlem, is this like long and angry track that draws parallels between Malcolm X and Ahmed Shah Massoud, the militant leader in Afghanistan. How does he make this case?
It's a very creative track, actually. And speaking of people who come up to Upper Manhattan in the Bronx, I mean, if you look at the video and his other videos, some of them are filmed actually in Upper Manhattan, Harlem, and the Bronx. Medine is a very interesting artist. There's little religious identity in his writing. What he is an admirer of the Black Panthers and Black Power. And what he does in that track is he imagines a conversation between Sheikh Massoud of the Northern Alliance and Malcolm X on the eve of their death, right? And he's talking about two figures who are products of Western policy, of the history of imperialism. And he tries to connect the history of the Black Freedom Movement and resistance in the West, in the New World, to what's going on in the developing world. And it's this kind of Black internationalism meets Islam that's interesting and that's resonant among Muslim youth today. You know, but the French cultural elite and the French state, to a certain degree, have tried to marginalize him and promote his rival, right? A fellow by the name of Abdul Malik.
So that's interesting because Medine doesn't get much airplay, which is a contrast with this guy you call probably the most celebrated French hip-hop artist of the last decade, Abd al-Malik.
Abdul Malik, that's right. And Abdul Malik's trajectory is very interesting. I mean, it reveals a particular kind of relationship, sort of the kind of intermingling that takes place between Islam and hip-hop. So Abdul Malik starts off as a street hustler, rapping with a group called the New African Poets. He had a lot of street cred when he was rapping with the African Poets. And then eventually he leaves all of that. He leaves the gangster rap, the radical hip-hop, and the Islamist identity and becomes a Sufi spoken word artist.
All right, so let me stop you right there because I'd like us to listen to this beautiful track of his called Gibraltar, right, and then come back and we'll talk a bit more about Abd al-Malik.
Sur le détroit de Gibraltar, y a un jeune noir qui n'est plus esclave, qui crie comme les braves. Même la mort n'est plus entrave. Il appelle au courage celles et ceux qui n'ont plus confiance. Il dit, ramons tous à la même cadence. Dans le bar, il y a un pianiste et le piano est sur les genoux. Le jeune noir tape des mains, hurle comme un fou. Fallait qu'elle sorte cette haine sourde
qui le tenait en laisse.
So Abd al-Malik, this is rap, but it's not as kind of tough as Medine, and it sounds like he's actually studied poetry and verse, and he's embraced by the French government.
Absolutely. As a graduate of the Sorbonne, he studied philosophy. He says we French rappers are the children of Public Enemy and Derrida, you know, that's his line. And he's very articulate, very smart. And the track that you played, he's talking about his relationship, you know, sort of how he goes down to North Africa and how he's sort of developed an attachment for sort of the Sufi traditions in North Africa. And what I think the French establishment, I mean, he's received every kind of award, Chevalier des Arts et des Lettres. And one reason is because he's not threatening. He doesn't see any contradiction between Islam and, you know, the Republic's values, between liberté, égalité, fraternité. And he sees his Islam as spirituality is compatible with laïcité. He also speaks an ethic of hard work and sort of pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And, you know, it's often juxtaposed to the protest that you hear in Medine's lyrics, Medine's videos. If you look at Medine's video, the imagery is... Again, it's Afghanistan, it's Guantanamo, it's the Patriot Act, it's waterboarding. And, you know, I like both artists, but I do think it's a problem when the state steps in to back one kind of hip-hop against another. The French state is particularly interventionist. You know, in 1994, the French government passed a law restricting the amount of American rap that could be played on French airwaves, on French radio stations. So the conversation about hip-hop in France is actually a stand-in for a much larger debate about what kind of Islam do you want in the public sphere.
How does this play out among the musicians themselves? I mean, in France, is there like a rivalry between, let's say, the Medine camp and the Abd al-Malik camp, the hardcore Muslims versus the Sufis?
There certainly is. There is some trash talking and so on. You know, what's interesting, and I speak about this, is that this effort, the Bush administration, the Blair government, and governments really across North Africa, you know, from Senegal all the way to Pakistan, this effort to use Sufism for de-radicalization and counter-extremism and sort of to gang-press Sufi poetry into a politics of counter-extremism would trigger a counterculture that I talk about called the Taqwa Corps, right? And these are sort of punk rockers who were disgusted by sort of the ultra-conservative Muslim attitudes against music, as well as government efforts to exploit this music for counterterrorism or whatever it may be, right? And so you get these groups such as the Kominas, you know.
Right, born right here punk, in Boston, Massachusetts.
Right, yeah. Punk rock, agnostic, anarchist kids from Boston, raised between Boston and Lahore, who would take on the establishment, right? Sort of these, you know, they would perform in London, they would perform in Pakistan, they come back to Boston, they get thrown out of the Islamic Society of North America at annual convention. So these young kids who are, you know, trying to append, you know, sort of to jangle everybody's nerves.
Fascinating stuff. Hisham Aidi is the author of Rebel Music, Race, Empire, and the New Muslim Youth Culture. We're going to link to your full playlist for our interview today at PRI.org. And thanks so much for speaking with us, Hisham. Great to meet you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thoughts in Chicago, remember how we tracked the top face of that night. 13 for noble dream.
You can also go to PRI.org to check out those videos of the dueling French-Muslim rappers we talked about. We close with a track from the Kominas called 9,000 Miles. The album is called Wild Nights at Guantanamo Bay. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow.
How can I swim 9,000 miles?
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org. The Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.